Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 72nd Venice Film Festival, and I'm joined by filmmaker Brady Corbet and screenwriter Mona Fassbold, who are here with the film The Childhood of a Leader. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, best way to start off this interview is, I'd like to ask you if you could introduce our listeners to the story of your film, first of all.
The film takes place in, or for the most part, it takes place in 1918 and 1919, just after the end or last shots fired of the First World War, and sort of chronicles the events leading up to this signing of the Treaty of Versailles 7 months later that bankrupted Germany and sort of paved the way for the Second World War. And it's about a little boy who's relocated to France with his family. His father is an American political advisor. And it's about their experiences over the course of about these 6 or 7 months.
Yeah. The obligatory question to follow that up is where you got the idea to actually develop this project.
I read a book a long time ago by Margaret Macmillan called Paris 1919, and it's a sort of the quintessential book on this subject. I found it really moving and particularly engaging. I'm interested in history, of course, and obviously, but I was particularly interested in this period of history, the Weimar Republic and the interwar period. And so I just started thinking of ways to approach it that would be poetic and unusual, because I wasn't really wanting to make a PBS documentary about it or anything. And then I felt that the project was too ambitious, and I put it down when I was only in the first act, basically. And then I was speaking many years later to Mona about it. We had started writing together. We wrote her first film together, which was called The Sleepwalker, which she directed. And when we were wrapping up the writing process on her film, we started talking about this, and she convinced me that it was actually a very tangible and realistic goal to get the film made, and that I shouldn't be thinking about the financing. We would pull it together somehow.
I was feeling very cocky at the time, because it was before we shot The Sleepwalker.
Yeah. and then we sort of got pummeled with both projects in some ways, and with the development of this project in particular. It was just stuck in limbo for a very long time. There were different cast members attached who only were not able to be a part of it because of the fact that we would change our dates by 6 weeks, and suddenly everybody was unavailable. I mean, it's always a jigsaw puzzle getting everyone in the same room at the same time. So it took a long time, and it was a rather arduous and painful process, honestly. We always had something keeping us going, you know? I mean, we lost the whole cast, but we always knew that Scott Walker was going to do the score. We obviously really kind of worship Scott's work and felt that it was imperative that he be involved. And that because the music was always conceived to be really a character in the film.
So you said that you were influenced by this original novel. How much of it then remained faithful to the way in which you brought
well,
it?
Well, it's that's not a piece of fiction. So it's just
it's just a document of the event.
Yeah, that was a reference for us. So the actual story is something that. That Brady dreamt up, and then we developed together over several years.
And the whole movie is rife with a lot of literary references. I mean, it gets its title from Jean-Paul Sartre's short story of the same name, but it's not the same story. But there's allusions to Robert Musil and. John Fowles, all sorts of people. So we conceived the project in such a way where we thought it would be really compelling to acknowledge a lot of the great works of the 20th century, whether it be literature, painting, or cinema, and try to speak to it somehow.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I did notice in the style too some Eisenstein or, you know, kind
of. Yeah, totally, totally.
It was awesome, by the way, and a mixing of archive footage at the start, which almost like, you know, strengthened the power that would follow with the period drama.
Yeah, I'm so happy you feel that way, because that was really hard to get right. We worked on the archives for 6 months because they come from hundreds of different sources, and we had to sift through really hundreds of hours. We owe that sequence though really to our editor, because he, you know, his father is a very famous filmmaker in Hungary who passed away a few years ago, but he's always handled his father's estate and retrospectives and stuff, and so he has a vast knowledge of post production, but he really knows a lot about archives. And it's a special skill set, and so we were very lucky to have him.
Yeah. Tell me now, even the way that the drama flows, it's very quiet, you know, and kind of very intense in that way too. Well, I'd like to know a little bit about the influences of the drama, but also the way in which you worked with the actors in achieving that kind of an atmosphere, a very dramatic, intense atmosphere, even though it's never too loud or, you know, or too too much, you know. Mm.
Well, I think that that's something that we are very excited about when we write, and also when we work with the actors, and also the sound design as well, is to create this expectation that something is about to happen, and to lead the audience in one direction and then take a turn in the opposite, and also to play with the audience in that way and be a little cheeky about it, and I think that's something that the actors also picked up on and really enjoyed as well, that. You don't have to commit to one sort of very simple choice or idea about your character. You're allowed to sort of be free within your character and see this mother is not a terrible mother. She is a woman, and she is a very intelligent woman who, you know, maybe doesn't really know how to be a mother. And this father is not necessarily a terrible father. He is
just a man of the period,
yes,
a man of the era.
This child is not a monster. This child is not necessarily a bad child even. He's just in this situation, in this household. And, you know, so letting the actors be free in that way, I think, it helps
inform.
Yeah, and this style. and that goes for you know, trickles down into the technicians and you know that you can, there's always room to play.
Actually, I must compliment you, because of course we got some really good performances from Liam Cunningham from Bernice Bejo, but the kid is really amazing. How did you work to get such a great performance from?
You know, it just took a really long time to find the right kid, but you know, the job's always really easy if you really cast the right person. And our casting director and his assistant, Des Hamilton, they saw a lot of people, of course. They were seeing people for months, and we kept seeing kids who were kind of interesting. Either they looked really great and had something a little it was maybe a little too Bressonian, the style of performance, a little too stiff, or it was the opposite. And then he sent me an email and said, I think we found the kid, and he sent me his picture, and he knew that we kept talking about Visconti and stuff, and saying, you know, we're looking for this kind of kid, and he was like, I think I got it, and then we were so anxious just to hear his voice. We were like, okay, like, just bring him in and talk to him, and he did. And then his voice was so amazing. And then I flew to meet him and his parents, and it was actually pretty simple after that. It was amazing. We didn't have to do that much. He took direction extremely well in terms of technical direction, because there's a lot of long sequence shots in the film, which is usually very difficult for focus marks and stuff for a child. But he was unbelievably good at it, because he treated it like a sport. He really cared about being very precise, you know, in the way that you want to get on first or second base, you know. So that was the other stuff, the natural charisma that he possesses. You know, you can't tell anybody to do that. They just have that or they don't have that.
As well as that, you kind of sort of hinted at it there in the last last answer, but I do want to talk about the visual style of the film. It's so well lit.
So basically, we shot the film three stops underexposed, and in very, very low lighting, which is the reason that the blacks have a lot of character. They're very rich, especially when they're projected on 35 millimeter, like we like them to be. And Lowell Crawley, he was the perfect combination for me of being very, very punk rock, but really having a classical understanding of cinematography. And we needed somebody who could move in a way. I mean, the last shot, for example, we needed to build a rig, a lightweight aluminum rig, in order to sort of do that. And he was excited about those things just as much as he was excited about producing, you know, images that recall Storaro or Sven Nykvist, you know. So it's so much of it is a process of knowing what you don't want. And if you are able to identify a lot of things that you are never going to do, that becomes sort of the dogma for the visual style of your movie. So, I mean, in terms of the operating, I don't like a camera to ever really move without it being motivated by a gesture. And I'd like the camera to move in a very geometrical kind of way. But in terms of the tone and the light, that's all Lowell. And our production designer is pretty amazing as well.
Pretty exciting film, and I really enjoyed it from start to finish. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thanks a lot. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.